From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Kelly McEvers. This episode, drones. The U.S. government says they're efficient, but a former pilot says there's too much collateral damage.
Good guys can die, bad guys can die, and innocents can die as well.
We've also got an update on a potentially game-changing week on U.S. policy in Syria. Here at home, NBA player Jason Collins made news this week when he told Sports Illustrated he's gay. But his coming out comes decades after a baseball player named Glenn Burke was found out by his teammates.
There were rumblings, because you have to remember, Glenn was open with his lifestyle.
Also, a firsthand account of what it was like to spend a decadent and depraved weekend at the Kentucky Derby.
Hunter maced people in the restaurant in order to get me out safe.
And the impossibly fun Somali music born before that country's decades of unrest.
People sang and played and danced in a very crazy way to the extent that some of them would fall down to the ground.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Today, we're taking a look at drone strikes and so-called targeted killings. In recent weeks, a faint light has begun to shine on this secretive program. Members of Congress are making speeches and statements, writing letters to the White House, and holding hearings here on Capitol Hill. We know the administration is reviewing some aspects of the program. And that's our cover story for today. Targeted killings, the people who carry them out, the people on the ground, and how we got here in the first place. The story starts after 9/11. Congress authorizes the president to use necessary force against suspected militants. The number of drone strikes on these suspects slowly increases over the years in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. Even though these drones are called unmanned vehicles, there's always someone at the controls.
My name is Brandon Bryant. I'm a former sensor operator for the United States Air Force Predator program.
We'll hear more from him later. Now on to 2008. Barack Obama is running for president, and he finds himself with a problem. He wants to close detention centers like Guantanamo Bay, but what to do with terrorists and suspected terrorists? Michael Boyle was Obama's counterterrorism advisor at the time. He spoke to us from member station WRTI in Philadelphia. Mr. Boyle, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so it's 2008. President Obama is about to be elected, and he's about to inherit the targeted killing program from the Bush administration. Why, at this time, is that program still attractive to the new president?
Well, I think if you put yourself in the position of President Obama in 2008, you realize that the United States doesn't have a lot of very good options in places like Pakistan and in Yemen. You have a situation under which if you contact the Pakistani government to tell them that you want to conduct an operation or engage in a strike, you often run across the problem that the information gets out to the potential target, thus ruining the strike. Drones appear to give you a very simple solution to this. You use an unmanned vehicle, you fly into the territory without notification, you take out a target, and you leave with relatively little fanfare.
Now that this administration is moving away from these detention centers, these rendition sites, these black sites, you know, it doesn't want to capture these combatants, has it basically boxed itself into a corner where it's actually easier to kill these targets?
Yes, the administration essentially is operating with a kill, not capture policy. It's not describing it as such, but that's effectively what the policy is. And there's a couple different reasons for this. I mean, one thing, to be fair to the administration, is that Guantanamo Bay is essentially a legal mess. And you also have a situation under which Congress has put a lot of pressure on the administration not to bring Guantanamo prisoners back to the United States. In that context, drones appear to solve your problem. You start using drones as a way of taking out terrorist targets. The problem with this is that you actually don't get intelligence from people who you kill, right? So one advantage of capturing people is that you get intelligence, but dead men tell no tales.
You know, there were more than 100 targeted killings last year. This year, the number has dropped considerably. Does that mean this administration is starting to get queasy about this program? Does it mean there's more scrutiny being applied to each attack?
There is some evidence that the administration is rethinking the policy. We know that when John Brennan was confirmed as CIA director, there was a sort of firestorm of criticism about the drones program, and he came under intense pressure from the Congress about the use of drones. It could be that the administration is beginning to rethink the policy. We also know the administration is thinking about the kind of bureaucratic housing of the policy. Does it go to the Pentagon? Does stay in the CIA, and where does that program properly belong? So I think a combination of those sort of factors is making the administration step back, in a sense, from drone strikes, which is probably a good thing.
That's Michael Boyle. He now teaches at LaSalle University. Recently, a young Yemeni man put a face to drone strikes before a Senate committee hearing. Faria al-Muslimi later told me how last month he got some terrible news from his village, Wasab.
It's a very beautiful, smooth village in the mountains where people are farming. Suddenly at night, something pops up and bombs him from the air. And it was a U.S. strike drones that terrified farmers there and terrified thousands of people.
Faria wasn't in the village at the time, but the reaction came to him on his cell phone.
My phone was stormed with SMSs, messages, phone calls from the village, people asking me, what is this? Why? What is happening? And people terrified on the phone speaking about this attack.
Witnesses say in all, 5 people died in that attack. The target was suspected militant Hamid Radami, who Faria says was well known in the village. He even spent time with government officials. Faria says it would have been easy to capture al-Radami.
I assure you, it's easier to capture him than capturing a gang member in New York City. And someone whom was in a great relationship with the government, that man was easy to capture, as one of the villagers put it. He says, you could have just shut the door of the security department 3 days ago when he was there.
He says now people in the village are reeling.
People are very angry. People are scared. Am I next?
Faria says in other Yemeni villages, this anger and fear has led people to actually join al-Qaeda. He says what the U.S. and the Yemeni government should do is focus on capturing these suspects.
United States of America has funded and supported a counterterrorism unit, the most elite forces and security forces in the country. All you need to do is take one of these soldiers, tell him, go to the village, bring me people like Hamid al-Radami and come. All you need to do is go arrest bad people.
Until then, people in Yemen are starting to assume these drone strikes are a way of life.
In areas other than that, like Rada', where late last year, a drone killed civilians also. A man from there told me that the mothers used in the past to tell their kids, go sleep or I will call your father. Now instead they say, go sleep or I will call the plane.
That's Yemeni writer and activist Faria al-Muslimi. Now let's hear about drone strikes from the other side, from the cockpit. Here's 27-year-old pilot Brandon Bryant speaking to us from Montana.
I originally joined to pay off a college debt.
In 2006, Bryant found himself wearing a flight suit and sitting in a kind of trailer in Las Vegas, Nevada, surrounded by monitors and the low hum of computers and servers. On his very first sortie as a pilot, Brandon watched from the drone's camera as American soldiers got blown up in Afghanistan. There was nothing he could do. That was before he'd ever taken his first so-called shot. I asked him about that. What was one of the more, if it's okay to talk about this, one of the more memorable moments when you had to do that?
I'll talk about my first shot because I still think about that.
This time, it was insurgents Brandon saw on the screen. One group who'd been firing at U.S. troops and another group who was standing away from them. Brandon was ordered to fire a missile at the second group.
We fired the missile, and 1.2 seconds after the missile fires, it sonic booms. And so the sonic boom gets there before the missile does, and the guy in the rear hears this, and he runs forward to the two guys in front, and then the missile hits. And after the smoke clears, there's a crater there. You can see body parts of the people, but the guy that was running from the rear to the front, his left leg had been taken off above the knee, and I watched him bleed out. The blood rapidly cooled to become the same color as the ground because we're watching this in infrared, and then I eventually watched the guy become the same color as the ground that he died on.
Wow. So these guys had weapons strapped on their backs, but you did not see them using them, threatening to use them in any way?
Correct. These guys had no hostile intent. And in my own mind, I thought of, you know, in Montana here, we have, everyone has a gun. Like, these guys could have been local people that had to protect themselves or or something similar to that. And I think we jumped the gun, you know.
Do you provide that information in any kind of follow-up reporting? You know, is there any exit interview where you report that information to your superiors?
There's an after-action report, but the pilots are the ones that put it together. And the only thing that was in there was enemy combatants, confirmed weapons, all three taken out by one by AGM-114 Hellfire Strike. So it doesn't really go into very much detail other than to tell what happened and what was the result.
I'm going to ask you one more hard question.
Okay.
Did you ever have to take a shot that hit someone that was clearly a civilian?
There was one. It's actually my second shot, which was about a month away after my first shot. This one was routine. We're watching this house, and end of my shift, it's coming close to being dawn in Vegas, and so it's nighttime over there, and there's very little activity. Like, every once in a while, a guy leaves the back of the house, and this guy was some sort of lieutenant of the commander of the area or something. I don't remember. I think there was supposedly three people left in the building, and all were military males. We just aim at the corner of the building. We're going to fire. And we do. And there's about 6 seconds left before the missile impacts, and something runs around the corner of the building, and it looked like a small person. There's no other way for me to describe it. It was a small, two-legged person, and missile hits. There's no sign of this person. The large portion of the building's collapsed. There's no movement coming in and out of the building. So we lock our camera on there, and I asked the screener who disseminates the video feed, I asked, can you review that? Like, what was that thing that ran on the screen? And he's like, 1 second reviewing, and comes back and says, oh, that was a dog.
When you reviewed that tape, what did you see?
It was a person. It was a small person. Like, it was no doubt in my mind that that was not an adult.
And that was the end of your shift, so you just, like, walked out into Nevada after that, right? What did it look like? You said the sun had just come up.
So I was getting out, but the sun was coming over the mountains off in the background, and I remember just kind of the light was too bright and the dark places were too dark. I felt really numb. I didn't feel distraught like I felt my first shot. I felt numb because this was the reality of war. Like, three instances in 3 months showed me pretty much every aspect that there is, that good guys can die, bad guys can die, and innocents can die as well.
And yet you didn't quit at that point. You kept doing it. What made you finally quit? What was it?
One day, it was late 2010, we had a wall that had five pictures on it of top Al-Qaeda leaders. And I remember walking in one day, and I kind of stopped and looked at one of these guys, and I was like, man, which one of these motherfuckers is going to die today? And I stopped myself, and I was like, that's not me. Like, that's just not who I am. I don't think like that. Like, I was taught to respect life. Even if in the realities of war that we have to take it, it should be done with respect. And I wanted this guy to die. So I tried to talk to a couple people about it. And one of the weird things about the whole drone community is that you don't talk about anything that you've done. You just don't. So I just shut up and didn't talk to anyone about how I was feeling or how I was doing.
So you quit?
Yeah, I couldn't do it anymore.
So what are you up to now?
Now I really have no clue what I'm doing with my life. Going to school at the university through the GI Bill, trying to figure out the next step of my life at the moment.
You've been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress, yeah?
Yes.
So are you being treated for any of that stuff?
A little bit. I see a therapist, but as far as like my veterans benefits and stuff, they tell me it takes like 1 to 2 years to get anything through. So paperwork was submitted in October. So possibly by October, I'll have my benefits and a place to call my own.
Brandon, Bryant, thank you so much for giving us your time and telling us your story.
Thank you for allowing me to do so.
Brandon Bryant was a drone pilot for 5 years. He's now part of an extreme sports program for veterans. To hear more about that and more of our conversation with Brandon, go to our website, npr.org. This week could represent a turning point in U.S. policy on Syria. The Obama administration says it's now considering providing arms to rebels in Syria who are fighting to bring down President Bashar al-Assad. That's if the U.S. can confirm Assad's forces did in fact use the debilitating nerve gas, sarin, in recent attacks. A senior administration official told me this week the new arms would most likely be shoulder-fired missiles, which could take down aircraft. And that's our cover story today, a game changer in Syria. If the U.S. does decide to provide more military assistance to the rebels in Syria, who would manage that? The job would likely go to a man named Salim Idris. He's the chief of staff of the so-called Free Syrian Army. The U.S. and its allies believe Idris represents moderate fighters in Syria, those who want to topple their president and install a democratic government. We reached General Idris in southern Turkey. He admitted the Free Syrian Army is not a traditional fighting force with a top-down command and control structure.
I don't like to say that we are working just like a regular army because the majority of the forces are civilians. And now we plan the military operation in not central manner.
Would shoulder-fired missiles be enough to turn the tide on the battlefield, we asked Idris. Would it help the rebels topple the Syrian regime?
It is not enough because we need other kinds of traditional weapons because the regime is supported from Russia and Iran and they have many, many kinds of weapons and a lot of military units. We hope to see a non-fly zone in Syria and that our friends do more pressure and speak with the Russian to prevent the regime in Damascus from using the Scud missiles.
The U.S. is not considering a full no-fly zone over Syria, but rather partial no-fly zones, where civilians would be protected and rebels could regroup. But as President Obama weighs these options, he's faced with a dilemma. There are other rebels on the ground in Syria, hardline Islamists who fall in line with al-Qaeda and its thinking, and who don't answer to the Free Syrian Army. I asked Idris, if the U.S. sends these sophisticated weapons into the fight, can he guarantee they won't fall into the hands of the Islamists?
We are ready to make lists of the weapons and to write down the serial numbers, and when we fall the regime, we are ready to give you back all these weapons.
It remains to be seen whether Idris could hold his men to that plan. While all the talk this week was about the use of chemical weapons in Syria and what the U.S. will do about it, there's also a growing concern here in Washington. The Syrian conflict is spreading to its neighbors. Syria is surrounded by Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Turkey, and tiny Lebanon, which had its own civil war back in the 70s and 80s. Back then, tit-for-tat kidnapping was a common tool in the war. It's thought that more than 10,000 people were kidnapped. Many of them were killed. And now the practice is surfacing again. And this time, it's all about Syria. I recently visited the Lebanese-Syrian border to find out more about what's happening there. I'm standing here in an area called Wadi Khalid. I am standing in Lebanon. And just beyond the border crossing is Syria. This border crossing used to mean that this area was pretty well off because there was a lot of smuggling. Now this border crossing is a totally different thing. It's a place where refugees cross every day from Syria into Lebanon, escaping the violence. This border crossing is also the place where a young man named Mohammed Hussein al-Ahmed disappeared. It was March 2012, in the afternoon. Mohammed went to exchange his phone for a new one. He never came home. We meet Mohammed's uncle and neighbor at a funeral in Wadi Khalid. Through an interpreter, they tell me once they realized Mohammed was missing, they made some calls and eventually learned he'd been taken by forces loyal to the Syrian government.
He was just a high school student. He did not belong to any political organization. None of us is politically active.
At first, the family hoped the demand would be for money. They made a few payouts here and there, but still nothing. Then they heard he was taken to a notorious prison in Syria.
So, I mean, how have they responded? If money won't work, what do you do?
We tried all methods.
The uncle and the neighbor smile. They tell me that a few weeks ago, they kidnapped 8 Syrians in retaliation. They like to call them guests.
The guests are a method of pressure.
The guests were from the Alawite sect, a minority sect that's the same one as the ruling elite in Syria, including the president, Bashar al-Assad. The Ahmed family hopes they can use these guests to pressure their high-ranking relatives to set young Mohammed free.
Do they ever think about, if this works, won't it encourage other people to do the same thing?
No, they say, this is just a local case. But it's not an isolated case. In recent months, there have been a handful of such kidnappings in Lebanon that are directly related to the Syrian conflict. One family recently paid $100,000 to get their relative back. Later on, I talked to Nadim Houri. He heads Human Rights Watch in Lebanon. He tells me he was surprised to hear people so openly admit they're involved in kidnappings.
What is really, frankly, really shocking is the impunity for the kidnapping. Those who kidnapped are known. They're not hiding it. They are meeting with activists, with journalists. They are describing what they've done. And yet the state is not doing anything to deter such behavior. If we can just get in a car and drive to these towns, the Lebanese police can drive to these towns. And actually, the army has checkpoints all around these towns, but they're, in some ways, they're being accessories to a crime.
The official policy of the Lebanese government is to stay out of the Syrian civil war. Lebanon is a small, weak state with its own sectarian problems. And everyone worries that if it gets involved, it will only bring more violence. The conflict in Syria can be hard to understand. Sunnis versus Alawites and Shiites, government versus rebels. Filmmaker Ali Lambert tried to make sense of the conflict during the month he recently spent in Syria. He managed to get access to both government soldiers and rebel fighters. The result was a film called Syria Behind the Lines. It recently aired on PBS's Frontline and can still be seen on its website. One thing that's clear, and it's something that's true in almost any civil war, the two sides simply don't know each other. Lambert joined us from London to talk about the film.
I would say that it's got beyond propaganda on both sides, because with propaganda, you always think that people are aware that it's kind of a narrative that's being promoted. What was much more shocking was to realise that the young people in the high school that I filmed with, when they were coming out with these chants about Bashar's, you know, name is written on the gun and they were going to die for the regime, they weren't saying it because they were propagandists. They were saying it because they absolutely believed it. And similarly, on the rebel side, the language and the vocabulary is all about martyrdom and, you know, death or freedom. I imagine that early on in the conflict, people would use these lines as lines of propaganda. But the more time I spent there, I actually realized that people really had absorbed those ideas into their DNA, that they were going to either win freedom or they're going to die in the process. Although both sides are in opposition, there was an incredible similarity about the way people spoke and their own kind of fears and anxieties and desires for what's going to happen in Syria.
The film is so striking, but what's also really striking is this kind of director's cut on the PBS website. It's called The Bombing of Al-Bara. It's when you're on the rebel side. And what happens is you're there when an airstrike hits the village. You run toward the scene of the bombing. We watch as injured and dead people are pulled from the rubble. And there's no rescue teams. I mean, did you get a sense that the relief effort was coordinated in any way after something like this happened?
I didn't get any sense of any organized relief operation. It's very ad hoc, and people are just scrabbling with their bare hands. The flip side is that it was incredible to see how this community rallied around. You know, hundreds of people are putting their lives at risk to stick around and try and rescue often complete strangers.
One moment that just sticks with me is it's a family that's clearly deciding to flee. A boy says he can't find shoes that match. A woman's stuffing her diploma into her purse, but it won't fit. Almost more than the dead and the dying, I remember this. What made you turn your camera away from the action and film that?
There's a great cameraman, and he always said that the best advice you could give to an observational documentary cameraman is a quick mind but slow feet. I kept saying this to myself over and over again. And what that means is, like, think very clearly about what's going on here, but don't feel you've got to run and rush, because usually what's happening around you will be a myriad of different images and stories. There were images that would stand out, such as their family with the shoes and the diploma in the bag. But it's those kind of images, strangely, that I knew were going to tell the real story. When I say real, I mean the broadest possible story. Because so much of the footage that comes out of conflict zones is always the sort of death and horror and shocking drama. And I'm far more moved, and I think people are far more moved, by those little human details that are taking place that we identify with.
That's filmmaker Ollie Lambert. These faraway images and stories he describes might have just gotten a little closer to home this week as the U.S. weighs its military options in Syria. This past week, Jason Collins became the first athlete who's active in major American team sports to announce that he's gay. His story reminded us of the story of Glenn Burke. Burke was an outfielder for the Los Angeles Dodgers in the 1970s when his teammates discovered he was gay. He didn't come out publicly until after he retired. It was a different time. Baseball and society were not ready for someone like Glenn Burke. He eventually paid a heavy price for being gay. His full story was told in the documentary Out, the Glenn Burke story.
Because you look over in his locker, you know, and he had his red jock in his locker. You know, nobody wore a red jock. You know, and Glenn wore a red jock, and, you know, he'd be dancing around in the clubhouse.
The producer of that documentary is Doug Harris.
Glenn Burke was said by many of the coaches and people within the Dodger organization that this kid is going to be the next Willie Mays. And so he was a very high candidate for stardom early in his career.
And for a long time, Glenn Burke's teammates had no idea that he was gay. And then, you know, the news kind of started to trickle out. Let's hear a scene from your film.
But I remember in spring training that the Latinos start calling Glenn names, you know, when I'm calling him a maricón.
There were rumblings about Glenn's lifestyle, because you have to remember, Glenn was open with his lifestyle. And this is at a time when Glenn was making the jump between the minor leagues to the major leagues, okay? So the people in the minor leagues, like the Latino players, they knew because Glenn was open about it. But now he's coming into the major leagues, but it had no bearing on their friendship with him. They supported him.
What happened when the management of the Dodgers found out that Glenn was gay?
They approached him with this special meeting and proposed to him to get married.
And they talked to him and offered him $75,000 to get married. And Glenn's first thing he told me, he said to them, what his comedy self was, I guess you mean to a woman. Started laughing.
And then eventually he was traded. In 1978, Glenn Burke was traded from the Dodgers to the Oakland A's. You know, Oakland was just across the bay from San Francisco, which back then was, you know, one of the few places where the gay community could live openly at the time. What was Glenn Burke's life like back then?
Glenn was a part of a management change after his first year with the A's. And Billy Martin, a renowned manager, came over from the Yankees. And Billy Martin was a staunch bigot. You know, word travels in baseball. And during spring training, Billy Martin
was introducing all the players to the new players that were coming in. And then he got to Glenn and he said, oh, by the way, this is Glenn Burke and he's a faggot.
Wow, what a welcoming for the new manager to give you to your teammates. And I think everything really went downhill from there.
Can you tell us what his last years were like?
Glenn Burke's last years were horrible. Glenn was in a terrible car accident. He got hit by a car walking across the street in San Francisco, and the injury made him immobile where he couldn't, you know, no longer participate in sports. And that was really tough for Glenn, and then his life resorted to drugs. And Glenn contracted the AIDS virus, I believe it was like in 1992.
And then he died 3 years later.
Yes.
In light of the Jason Collins announcement this week, how do you want Glenn Burke to be remembered?
Well, for me, I'd like for people to remember Glenn Burke as the kind, the warm, the fun-loving. You know, the best memory that I have in producing the film about Glenn Burke was a comment that one of his teammates made about him, that he was the heart and soul of the great Los Angeles Dodgers championship teams of the late 70s. And all of his teammates will always remember him as such.
Glenn Burke playing center field tonight. His first World Series appearance. He takes the first pitch.
That's Doug Harris. He's the producer behind the 2010 documentary Out, the Glenn Burke story. Mr. Harris, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Today is Derby Day, the 139th Kentucky Derby. This race has always been a spectacle. Big hats, big bets, and as Hunter S. Thompson described it, big drinking.
That whole thing, I said, will be jammed with people. 50,000 or so. Most of them staggering drunk. It's a fantastic scene. Thousands of people fainting, crying, copulating, trampling each other, fighting with broken whiskey bottles.
That's actor Tim Robbins reading from an essay Thompson wrote in 1970 called The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved. The essay chronicles a very boozy weekend, something Thompson later became famous for. And it was this essay that first inspired the term gonzo journalism. Thompson's companion that weekend was British illustrator Ralph Steadman. The two eventually would become lifelong collaborators, all the Fear and Loathing projects, the Rolling Stone articles. The 1970 Derby is the first time the two ever met. Steadman says it took them 2 days to find each other. When they finally did meet, the drinking started almost immediately.
I turned around and this bullet head of a man, huge, 6'4", standing in front of me, he said, are you from England? Yes. Are you Hunter S. Thompson? He said, yes, I am. Maybe we should get a beer together and sit down.
Did you ever manage to see the actual race?
Yeah, we went into the inner field first and just to look at the people. We were really looking for odd faces, people that were kind of weird, you know. That seemed to become our real purpose.
He had done a few good sketches, but so far we hadn't seen that special kind of face that I felt we would need for our lead drawing. It was a face I'd seen 1,000 times at every derby I'd ever been to. I saw it in my head as the mask of the whiskey gentry. A pretentious mix of booze, failed dreams, and a terminal identity crisis.
The face of the whiskey gentry. Was that his idea? Was that your idea? Did you guys come up with it together?
No, that was his idea, actually. That's what, you see, he becomes part of the story. And that's what always happened with us. We sort of melded together.
What was it like to work with this guy? I mean, there's this passage in the Kentucky Derby essay where he says you guys got kicked out of a restaurant because of you and your disturbing drawings.
Well,
but actually,
I kept drawing people everywhere I was. I had a habit. I had a compulsion. Still do. A compulsion to draw things. I mean, in a funny sort of way, he was an old-fashioned Kentucky boy. He took me to meet his friends at the Penn Dennis Club. Some guy and his wife. And the wife got sort of interested. And she said, will you draw me? So I started drawing her, scribbling her down. She says, That ain't pretty. I'm pretty, ain't I? And Hunter said, stop that filthy scribbling, Ralph.
But then you say that it's because he maced the waiter.
Yeah, he did, yeah. Hunter maced people in the restaurant in order to get me out safe.
Good to know. At the end of this essay, Hunter Thompson actually spies the face, you know, that you guys have been looking for this whole time, the whiskey gentry. Let's listen here for a second.
There he was, by God! A puffy, drink-ravaged, disease-ridden caricature, like an awful cartoon version of an old snapshot in some once-proud mother's family photo album. It was the face we've been looking for. And it was, of course, my own.
So it's true. You guys were that depraved by the end of the
weekend. We were, by the end of the week, yeah. He sent me off. I thought I'd never speak to him again.
He kicks you. I mean, he kicks you out of the car.
He took me to the airport and said, get the hell out of here, you damn scumbag, you know.
Was there a point when the two of you kind of had to make up?
No. I just thought I'd never hear from him again. I did go back to England. Then I heard from Hunter. Rolf, do you want to come back over here? I said, well, what for? You told me to get out of here. Well, that was just talk, Ralph, just talk. I think I had a good time, you know. I hope you did. So I said, yeah, up to a point, yes. It was great.
You are also the artist for Flying Dog beer labels. I just want to tell you we're cracking open a bottle of that beer right now. Here goes.
There you go.
In your honor, going to take a little drink here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bless you. That's lovely. That's great.
Thank you so much. Ralph Steadman, cartoonist, artist, and longtime collaborator with Hunter S. Thompson. Mr. Steadman, thanks again.
Well, bless your heart. Absolutely wonderful speaking to you.
A retrospective of Ralph Steadman's work has just opened at the Cartoon Museum in London, and those recordings you heard of Hunter S. Thompson's essay were released last year with Tim Robbins as Thompson and Mr. Steadman as himself. And it's time for some music. Some super funky music. This is Durdur Band, and this is the sound of Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, in the mid-1980s. It's a time and place most people can't actually imagine, a city that's long gone. That's why the recent re-release of Durdur's hit tape Volume 5 has caused a bit of a stir among some music critics. The founders of Durdur now live in Columbus, Ohio. We asked them and an interpreter to go to a studio and talk to us about the newly released record. Abdinur Daljer and Sahra Dawo join us from member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Durdur Band, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And welcome. Thank you very much for having us.
Tell us what that scene was like, that nightclub scene in Mogadishu in the 1980s. Of course, when we hear the word Mogadishu, we think of something very different. Take us back and let us feel what it was like then.
In the beginning, we used to sing and dance with American music. And later on, we decided to shape our own music in such a way that it is comfortable enough for people to dance with it, for people to enjoy it.
So you took these sort of very traditional sounding Somali songs and Somali lyrics and put them to these very, very funky Western beats and made something new.
Yes, we have followed the Somali traditional way of composing, of writing of the songs, and we were combined the Western music and the Somali song in such a way that it made people want to dance.
Waqtigan ukulani yo waraysi barashadeni. Album ka esku chitake.
The lyrics that I just sang are part of the Volume 5 music that was just released in the new album. It's called Ilawat Ashafa, which means move the love with me.
When you first started, the band was only, you know, four musicians. Eventually, it grew to more than a dozen people. I want to listen to a song from this re-released album. This track is called Doyo. So we're hearing keyboard, drums, guitars, horns. It's very funky. But then you hear Sahara's voice. if you could transport yourself back to then and you're standing on the stage and you're singing Doyo, what does the nightclub look like? You know, what do you see from the stage?
When I sing this song, people always requested for repeats, and people sang and played and danced in a very crazy way to the extent that some of them would fall down to the ground and they would keep asking for repetitions 3, 4, 5 times sometimes.
Were there other bands like you in Mogadishu at the time?
Marcasco. There were a couple of other bands, Sharero and Iftin, which were also privately run, while every other band was part of the government's ministry.
I'm sure you're going to tell me that you were the best. You had more crowds at your nightclub than the other guys, right?
In fact, we had more fans and more supporters and more audience in our music. Our music was so unique that it attracted everybody, including other musicians.
Well, we are not surprised by that because we like it too. Can you tell us when you left Somalia?
So in 1992, when the conflict occurred in Somalia, we decided to leave as a band and we went into Ethiopia and we started performing in Ethiopia. We recorded an album in Ethiopia as well.
Now you live in Columbus, Ohio, and you own a record shop there. Do you guys still make music?
Yes, we have been producing songs, but this time the songs that we have been producing were based on the situation in Somalia, which is terrible. We were promoting things like graduation from high schools and colleges so that young people can become more productive and more helpful to their communities. There is a song that we sang in 1992 when we left Somalia. What we are doing is we are taking responsibility for what happened in Somalia. We're saying that is our responsibility. It's something that we did, and we're asking for forgiveness, and we're asking for God to give us his forgiveness and his mercy and his kindness from above and to bless Somalia with peace. So that is the essence of the song.
Abdunur Dalger and Sahra Dawo are two members of the Somali music group Dordor Band. The band's hit tape Volume 5 has just been re-released. Dordor Band, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to know more about the music scene in Mogadishu in the 80s, so we asked NPR's East Africa correspondent, Gregory Warner, to talk to some Somali musicians who now live in Nairobi. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Kelly.
Can you help us understand the music scene in the 80s?
Absolutely. And to do that, I need to rewind the clock a little bit to the 1960s. So if you were, say, a hippie backpacking through Mogadishu in 1963, this is the music that you would have heard. You asked me to talk to some Somali musicians in Nairobi, so I rented a hotel room in Little Mogadishu, Eastleigh, in the neighborhood in Nairobi, where many Somali refugees live. And I invited musicians to come talk to me. I didn't actually realize they'd bring their instruments. So here's this musician. She was very famous back in the day. Her name is Khadija Fode Noor, and she brought her oud and started playing it for me. So this is a classic Somali love song, definitely untouched by Western music, Western rock and roll. Then comes 1969, there's a coup. A general named Siad Barre establishes a communist dictatorship, and he gives a speech that all the musicians that I talk to, all the Somali musicians that I talk to in Nairobi remember, where he says to the musicians, he says, "You're part of our revolution. We're going to give you a good salary. We're going to give you, some of you, nice houses in town so that this communist revolution that we've started can proceed to the beat of the best songs, the best poems, the best dances that Somali artists can create."
So how does that start changing the sound of Somali music?
Well, turn on the radio in Somalia in the 1970s, and you can hear Elvis Presley, James Brown, Bob Marley, Etta James, And the government's not only bringing in music, but they're allowing in instruments. So trumpets, saxophones, later Moog synths, Gibson guitars. You know, Somalia went electric before most of the country had electricity. I think it might have sounded something like this. Okay, I'm not going to play too much of that because it's a bit cacophonous. But this does set the stage for a band like Dur Dur that picks up those instruments later and, you know, makes them funky fresh.
So by the 80s, you've got bands like Dur Dur and, you know, Iftin, or Dur Dur's main competitor at the time, playing the nightclubs. What are other bands doing at that time?
The broader picture in the 80s is that the dictatorship started to crumble. And so while you still have this official party line, you also have samizdat, the dissident music. And so this is an example of that kind of underground scene. This is a song from 1990 called Land Cruiser. So Land Cruiser, as you can guess from the title, it takes a not very friendly look at the automobile buying habits of the communist elite. Now this song hits the underground circuit in, as I said, 1990. By 1991, the communist government is overthrown. Somalia doesn't have a central government again for 20 years.
So you're saying that the musicians that were built up by the communist government played a major role in bringing down that government?
I don't know how much of a role they played, but I do know that they definitely feel responsible. I put this question to one of the musicians. We heard her earlier playing that traditional Somali song. And I asked her, do you regret singing dissident songs against the regime? And she said, yeah. And she was speaking through a translator.
Yes. She said, really, we were expecting only for change. But we never expected total collapse of life. So we are very much regret. And we are saluting the old regimes. We say, we are sorry. Sorry what happened.
She says, this is a song of regret.
NPR's Gregory Warner joined us from Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Kelly.
For the week ending May 5th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Connor Donovan, and Becky Sullivan. Our intern is Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Kelly McEvers. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.